This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Good day. Welcome to New Books in History, a podcast channel of New Books Network. My name is Dr. Charles Cotillo of the Royal Historical Society. I'm a host on the channel, and today I'm pleased to have with us Professor Richard Toy. He is Professor of History at University of Exeter and is acclaimed author of a good number of books dealing with the life and times of Sir Winston Churchill. And today we are dealing with his latest book, Winston Churchill, A Life in the News, published by Oxford University Press. Welcome, Professor Toy.
Thank you very much.
Professor, what is the thesis of your book?
Well, it's really sort of three different strands of the book. The first is about Churchill's life as a journalist. So as a young man, he started out making a name for himself, not only by fighting in the Imperial Wars, but also in writing about them. And he continued his journalism actually until the late 1940s, though on he became more sporadic. By the late 1940s, he was doing much less of it, but it was still a consistent theme in his life. A second theme is the way in which he was portrayed in the media. And then the third theme is his efforts to control or influence the media. So sort of one of the themes of the book is the ways in which, particularly during World War II, he became distressed and angry about the press coverage and made attempts of varying levels of success to sort of control or influence what the press were writing about him.
Why did you begin the book with this vignette about an argument that Churchill had in June of 1929 with the Socialist Daily Herald?
Well, I thought it was a rather fascinating story. So the story is that he was photographed by the Daily Herald, and in fact by other newspapers as well, as he was leaving Downing Street, and he was carrying a book with the title War, which was a famous anti-war novel. And the Herald sort of published this with a rather sarcastic caption saying that war was Mr. Churchill's favourite subject, rather implying that he was a warmonger. And Churchill sort of took against this and concluded falsely that the picture had been faked because the title wasn't showing in the photos which the other papers had taken, but in fact it was simply that they'd been photographing it from a slightly different angle. And the Herald went to the Morning Post, which is sort of its ideological opposite, a very right-wing paper, and sort of got it to validate the fact that the negatives hadn't been faked. And so it seemed to me, first of all, this was simply an interesting story, because this had sort of been entirely forgotten about in the years since it happened. It was admittedly sort of more of a steep storm in a teacup, not a major episode. But also, I think it showed Churchill's sensitivity towards the press and his willingness to lash out even when often he wasn't justified in doing so.
In what way or fashion was Churchill's early journalism unusual and or novel for his time?
Well, I think it was unusual because actually it was very well written. And I'm not saying that other Victorian journalists didn't write well, but I think that there's a kind of a reflective quality in Churchill's journalism. He didn't just want it to be a sort of a sequence of exciting events, although he certainly wanted to tell those. But in contrast to other people who were sort of covering the same conflict, he was much more interested in, you know, sort of making grand statements about the significance of what was going on and making almost philosophical claims, if you like. So I think that the idea of people sort of going to foreign places and sending back lengthy letters about them was not particularly novel. But I think the novelty or Churchill's skill really lay in his ability to use language and for description, but also to actually attempt to make people think.
Quite early in the book, you make reference to Churchill as being, quote, a publicity politician, unquote. Was Rosebery, Chamberlain, or for that matter, Balfour, publicity politicians?
Not in the same way, I think. I think that those other men that you mentioned could rely to a greater extent on being able to make their way in politics without needing to sort of get this kind of sensational media coverage. And remember that Churchill did do things which were far more sensational than anything that any of them ever did, by escaping from prison in South Africa, to give but one example. And I think that of course, he was not exactly underprivileged, but he did have problems with money. And in order to get into politics, he really needed to kind of raise a lot of money and to gain a lot of attention, because although he sort of came from a political family, his father, Lord Randolph Churchill, was, of course, somebody who had whose career had burned out, and that sort of a relationship to Lord Randolph wasn't really going to necessarily get Winston Churchill very far. So I think that he was probably much more enthusiastic for publicity. I mean, it was instrumental, but I think that he also enjoyed it in a way in which the other figures that you mentioned certainly didn't do to the same extent.
How did Churchill cope with the changed atmosphere in political press relations engendered by the outbreak of the Great War?
Well, I think that his hope, really, at the outbreak of war, when he was first Lord of the Admiralty, was that essentially the press would follow the instructions that were given to it. And to a certain extent it did, but this could be counterproductive. So I have a story in the book about the sinking of a particular ship where Churchill insisted that the story not be reported. And indeed the press did follow the instructions and this was kept under wraps until 1918. But of course it was really didn't make a lot of sense to keep this information secret because, of course, there had been survivors who had come ashore and the word had spread. Of course, the Germans, sort of Churchill's justification for keeping secret is that we mustn't let the Germans know. But the Germans certainly did know, and it made it into their newspapers quite early on. So I think that, he didn't necessarily understand fully how the press actually worked. And so that, he wanted to exercise a kind of command and control approach to the press, which was probably quite typical, not only for him, but for many other politicians as well. I think he may have learned more as time went on, but I think in that particular instance, certainly it was counterproductive.
Which politician do you think, in retrospect, best handled the press during the Great War?
Oh, that's a very good question. I mean, there are different, depends what you mean by sort of handled it well, but in the sense for the purposes of sort of successful self-promotion,
yes,
I would say that Lloyd George really did do so, and that he did so in part by giving a series of very effective speeches in sort of 1914 to 15 onwards, which really helped establish his credentials for becoming prime minister, and he managed to create a kind of a sense of urgency and a belief that he was the one who was really concerned about getting more munitions made and so forth. So, and he would certainly, when he was told that he was sort of giving the speeches at the wrong time of day in order to get maximum coverage, he would simply change the time at which he gave the speech. So I think he was somebody who was very effective with the press during that period. Although, of course, after World War One, the amount of criticism that he got increased and eventually contributed certainly to his downfall in 1922. So I think that there's a sort of degree to which there is a sort of a tide in the affairs of men, and it's not just about whether or not you were innately good at manipulating the press. It really is about the conditions in which you were trying to do so, and that when you are you're sort of running with the tide, if you like, then it all seems terribly easy. And when the tide turns and the press turns on you, then the things which you've previously done and which have been effective before suddenly cease to work. And that politicians can find that incredibly disorientating, I think.
Did Churchill obtain any positive publicity from the fact of resigning from the government in late 1915 and going out to France to fight in the trenches?
Yes, he did. And I think it's worth saying that, he rather felt, and I mean, of course, it's true that he got an awful lot of abuse as well, but he rather felt that he was sort of, the most abused man, if you like. But in fact, it's worth saying that at more or less all points during World War One, he found supporters, that there were people who would stand up for him. And so, what he did was newsworthy. And certainly, it's interesting, not only that he got sort of quite good coverage for leaving the aid of France, but also there wasn't any particular backlash against him when he came back either. So, although I do want to emphasize that although I point out that Churchill was very sensitive towards the press, of course, it has to be understood that he was under an enormous amount of pressure, that he wasn't necessarily that different in the degree of his sensitivity from other politicians. But also, perhaps he didn't really see very difficult when you're on the receiving end of press coverage to look at it in the round and see, well, actually, I am getting a fair amount of good coverage too.
What was Churchill's relations with those two very different press lords, Lord Northcliffe and Lord Beaverbrook?
Well, I would say the difference is that with Beaverbrook, he was genuinely friends with him. And I think that the relationship with Lord Northcliffe, although there were times when they claimed to be getting on well with each other, I think it was a difficult arm's length relationship, which was much more instrumental for Churchill. That was a relationship which had many ups and downs, but fundamentally, I don't think that Northcliffe really liked Churchill very much, or vice versa. Whereas with Beaverbrook, although it got Churchill into trouble in various ways, I think that Churchill enjoyed Beaverbrook's mischievous nature. And so he could be maybe tempted by Beaverbrook to do unwise things on occasion, but I think that he sort of genuinely got pleasure out of that relationship.
Post-war, what were, if any, changes in Churchill's relations with the press?
Post-World War One.
Yes.
I suppose, you've sort of got to divide it into two periods, because, of course, there's the famous wilderness years, and maybe worth focusing on that period. I would say that sort of during the up until 1930, 1931, he sort of continued in more or less the same way, in that there were some papers that were sort of piling abuse on him, and there were others which were giving him a fair measure of support. After 1931, when he's simply a backbencher, although a very prominent backbencher, again, he felt that he was being unjustly excluded from not only the press, but from, by this point, the BBC. And that's a key change as well, the introduction of electronic media, film, and newsreels and radio. At the same time, it's worth saying that, of course, Churchill did have access to considerable press coverage. He had his own column in various different newspapers throughout the decade, even when that went against sometimes the editorial line of those papers. Although he kind of felt marginalised, particularly towards the end of the decade, as the Munich Agreement starts to be really his claims about it proven to be justified, then there is a sort of a big pro-Churchill movement that springs up in the press. So, the government was certainly trying to manipulate the press in general in its own interests and therefore rather against Churchill. And so I think it's he had some grounds for complaint. But again, it is just worth emphasizing the high degree of access to press coverage which he still had.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
And what was Churchill's relations with the early BBC?
Well, of course, the general strike here is crucial. The general strike of 1926, when Churchill took over the running of the, or helps establish the sort of the government newspaper, the British Gazette. And again, he wanted to really turn the BBC into a propaganda arm of the government, as the British Gazette was. Now, John Reith, who was the Director General of the BBC, actually was really pretty much totally on the side of the government during the strike, but felt that the BBC needed to preserve an appearance, at least, of independence, at least in some sense of a kind of arm's length relationship. And that was probably wise, actually, from the point of view of good propaganda. But Churchill didn't really sort of grasp that, and continually, really for the rest of his career, was quite hostile to the BBC. In the 1950s, sort of saying it was filled with communists and so forth. And so I think that, again, you might say that for somebody who was simply a backbencher, Churchill got a reasonable degree of access to BBC and made a number of broadcasts during the 1930s. But, of course, you've got to remember that BBC coverage was very different in those days. You didn't have the news programs were essentially somebody reading out a script. You didn't have interviews, so Churchill couldn't just expect somebody to come and stick a microphone in front of his face and ask him for a comment. When he went on the radio, he was, on a number of occasions going on and giving a full-length broadcast.
Was Churchill at all aware of the abuse he was receiving from the sheet truth? And was he at all familiar with who was behind it? And in essence, it was a mouthpiece for Chamberlain?
I feel sure that he was aware of it, actually, because one thing which the book makes clear is that, you know, he was a voracious reader of the press. And I don't really have any particular evidence of him reacting or responding to a, you know, particular article or a particular issue of truth. But I'm sure that, you know, the Westminster Gossip of such would be that he, well, A, he'd definitely been aware of the coverage, and B, he'd probably been aware of, he may not have known the details, but the sense that the government were behind this, I'm sure that he would have been aware of that. I'm not sure that specifically he was particularly upset about truth in particular. At least I can only say that I haven't come across strong evidence that he was.
Was there a marked change in the coverage, in the interaction with the press between Chamberlain and Churchill after September 1939?
Well, again, as sort of First Lord of the Admiralty, Churchill is then sort of very keen to control news of sinkings, for example, and he wants to be the one who sort of releases the news, and he kind of wants to some extent manipulate the information so that when a piece of bad news comes out, it is, you know, matched by a piece of good news, which means kind of holding up bits of information if need be to sort of try and make it come out the right way. He's maybe more effective at doing that during the Second World War than he was during the First World War. And also, I think that Churchill does make broadcasts in the, well, during the phony war period, where he maybe comes across as significantly more dynamic than Chamberlain, and as a more effective broadcaster, which certainly helps set him up for taking over the premiership in May 1940. I think that, although one or two historians have maybe suggested otherwise, I don't think that Churchill is directly trying to manipulate the press in his own interests in order to be able to take over. I don't see evidence that he was disloyal to Churchill, to Chamberlain, and was stirring up the press to that effect.
May 1940, do you see more continuity or discontinuity in the way the press was handled by the government?
Probably, broadly speaking, continuity, insofar as if Churchill had been upset that the press had been kind of manipulated against him before September 1939, then he still wanted the government to continue to have control. So I don't think that there's, maybe the biggest shift comes when Brendan Bracken later on takes over the Ministry of Information. Is probably a more effective Minister of Information than Duff Cooper, who was taking that role from 1940 onwards. So I think that I don't think there's some sort of revolution which occurs on account of Churchill becoming Prime Minister. And as I say, it is Bracken becoming Minister of Information later in the war, which probably, again, I wouldn't say it was revolutionary, but I think it is actually a move in the right direction. Church has appointed an effective person who actually does really understand the press in a way which Churchill personally maybe didn't.
Was Churchill's handling of the press and the press campaign in the 1945 election the reasons why the Conservatives lost?
Probably not, in that most scholars would agree, I think, that the real key change in public opinion had come earlier in the war. We know that opinion polls were being produced from June 1943 onwards, and the Conservatives were consistently behind. And so Churchill suffers really in part from the unpopularity of the Conservative Party. We know that he personally is very popular. So I think that he has an uphill, a very big hill to climb, and also that actually, compared to the opinion polls earlier in the year, that the campaign meant that the Conservatives reclaimed some lost ground. So I think it's clearly the case that the Conservatives didn't manage to sort of get the killer issue that they wanted, and they were obviously sort of searching around for various ways to try and undermine Labour. So they certainly didn't have any great success in finding really effective themes. But certainly I wouldn't put, I mean, Churchill felt that he might have done better if he had more support from the Times, for example. I think he was quite resentful about that. But I think that, you know, what Labour benefits from is that papers like, in particular, the Daily Mirror, a mass market paper which has moved from, you know, at the beginning of the century, it had been a Conservative paper. During the 1930s, it moved very much to the left. So Labour benefited from that, and that probably wasn't anything that Churchill or his ministers could have said, which was really going to change the Daily Mirror's editorial line.
Why was Churchill so unenthusiastic about television as a medium?
Well, I think partly simply because by the time it came along, he was very old, and that familiarising himself with a new medium was rather difficult. I think, you know, of course, the medium doesn't look terribly different from newsreel to some extent. And I think that Churchill was good with newsreel in that when he was doing walkabouts, for example, after through bombed areas and sort of waving his hat on a stick, he was brilliant at that kind of showmanship. I think he was less effective when he was speaking directly to camera, oddly, even though, of course, he was such an effective broadcaster. So I think that, one might say that if television had come along when Churchill was a young man, he'd probably have taken the trouble to master it and could have been a brilliant performer. But simply, you know, having done things in a particular way for a very long time, it obviously becomes difficult to adjust to new technology the older that you get.
Into too much. Overall, how would you compare Churchill's relations with the press with other 20th century prime ministers?
Well, I think he probably fits into a fairly consistent pattern, which is that most prime ministers have felt sensitive about the press and have lashed out at it in various ways. And of course, that's understandable because that person is the person who is the most prominent political figure in the country and is going to be on the receiving end of most criticism. I mean, I think that there are some prime ministers, maybe Harold Macmillan, James Callaghan, who are perhaps were a bit more phlegmatic about it. So, but one can see other prime ministers such as Margaret Thatcher, for example, John Major, very, very sensitive about the press. So I think that I would also just say that maybe Churchill was the most innovative of 20th century prime ministers, with the possible exception of Lloyd George in their dealings with the press, partly because he really had this. He did, although I say I don't think he completely understood how Fleet Street worked, because he was never a journalist who worked on a paper in a newspaper building. But he did have the skill set of journalism. He did know how to write an effective article. He did know how to grab the reader's attention. And of course, he made a great deal of money doing it. So I think that his all-round skills in this respect were very impressive.
If you wanted people to take one thing away from your book, Professor, what would it be?
Gosh, I think it would simply be that being a prominent political leader is a very challenging job. It's obviously very understandable when people react to it, react to criticism in a sort of a harsh way when they feel they've been unfairly treated. I think the message would be that, although maybe there was sort of a close call during World War II when Churchill really had a very strong instinct to shut down the Daily Mirror when he felt it was being too critical, which I think would have been a bad thing for press freedom. I think that ultimately, his sometimes kind of repressive instincts weren't generally put into effect because other people, didn't simply rush around actually to do his bidding, that they realized that maybe he needed to be deflected or humored in various ways. And so I think it is these sort of institutional restraints which helped preserve press freedom. And I think those are important, given that it is quite natural that politicians will often react in a way which, on the face of it, looks oversensitive.
On that observation, I would like to thank you very much, Professor, for being so kind as to speak with us today. This is Charles Cotillo. Thanks for listening to New Books in History, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. Thank you, Professor Toy.
Thank you very much.